millions of virus-sized machines that maintained the rings kept them from falling apart and sent signals into deep space. No human hands had built the nanos that dwelt in Saturn's rings. They were alien constructs, left behind by intelligent extraterrestrials who had once visited the solar system. But none of that interested Pancho Lane at this particular moment. She was striding along one of the habitat's flower-bordered lanes, muttering a string of choice curses under her breath. She was a tall, lean, long-legged woman who had once been a daredevil astronaut, then worked her way up the organizational ladder to become head of the vast Astro Manufacturing Corporation. Long since retired, she still had the restless energy and keen intelligence that had carried her across the solar system. She was a West Texas girl, partly of African-American descent. Her years as a corporate executive had not changed her outlook on life very much. With the West Texas twang that still marked her speech, she called a spade, or more often a goddamn shovel. Pancho had come to Goddard not as an exile, but as a VIP visitor, years after the habitat had established itself in orbit around Saturn. She had stayed for more than 3 decades, married her erstwhile bodyguard, and had a daughter by him, a daughter who was now 8.6 light-years away. "What's got you so riled up?" asked Jake Wanamaker, striding along beside her. A retired admiral and one-time security chief for Astro Corporation's CEO, her husband was taller than Pancho by half a dozen centimeters, broad-shouldered, thick-bodied, his craggy face ruggedly handsome. Pancho just kept on muttering. "What is it?" Wanamaker asked again, his gravelly voice taking on an edge. Pancho gave him a look.
"Mark Twain said, when angry, count to four. When very angry, swear. So I'm swearing."
"About what?"
"Those pansy-livered, paper-pushing, brain-dead flatlanders back Earthside."
Understanding dawned. The IAA.
"And the World Council. That damn Chang and the whole bunch of them."
"And Trish," Wanamaker added. Pancho acknowledged the fact with an angry nod.
"They're leaving her and the others hanging out there on their own. No backup. 12 people out there by themselves."
"Trish knew the risks when she signed on for the mission," Wanamaker said tightly.
"That's your Navy background talking," Pancho muttered.
Wanamaker grasped her forearm, gently, but firmly enough to stop her single-minded march. With a crooked grin, he asked his wife, "Where are you heading, lady?"
"Comm center, over in the village."
"To call who?"
"Whom?"
"Whatever. What are you up to, Ponch?"
"I'm going to call Doug Stavanger. He's the only one in this whole twirling solar system who's got 2 grams of brains in his head."
"Thank you."
"Ah, Jake, you know what I mean."
"What do you intend to tell Stavanger? You can't expect Cellini to go to the expense of building another starship."
"No, we're going to do that."
"We are?
Goddard?"
Wanamaker's surprise was palpable. Pancho resumed striding toward the nearby village with its whitewashed buildings that housed government offices and the communications center. Wanamaker hurried to keep pace with her.
"We've got another habitat module half-built, parked alongside us. Why not convert it into a starship?"
"Convert it?" Wanamaker looked stunned with surprise. "And what do we do, just donate it to those flatlanders?"
"Yep."
"Our governing council will never go for it, Pancho, you know that. Even if they did, the people would call for a general vote, and they'd turn it down flat."
"Not if there's a quid pro quo."
"What's the quid, and what's the quo?"
"We turn the habitat we're building into a starship, outfit it with fusion engines, and offer it to the IAA. A ship that'll hold hundreds of scientists. Thousands."
"In return for?"
"Full official pardons for each and every mother-loving person aboard Goddard. Total exoneration."
Wanamaker frowned with thought. "But they've been living here for more than half a century, Punch. Most of them won't want to return to Earth. This is their home now."
Nodding, Pancho said, "I know that. But don't you think they'd like to have the freedom to return to Earth if they want to? To visit the world they were born on? To have the stigma of exile wiped away so that their children could go to Earth if they'd like?"
"The way Trish went to Earth," Wanamaker murmured.
"To build her own life, yeah. The exile's kids can't do that. Not yet."
Musing aloud, Wanamaker said, "So we offer a completed starship to the IAA."
"In return for full pardons for each of the exiles."
"Stavanger and Cellini lead the effort to staff a backup mission to Sirius."
"So Trish won't be stuck out there for the rest of her life."
"And the World Council will be too embarrassed to turn down your offer."
"They know most of the exiles will stay here, It's home for them now, has been for decades. But their kids will be free to go Earthside.
Wanamaker rubbed his square jaw as they walked. Poncho, I'd rather hand it to you. It might work. It really might work.
It's a win-win proposition. And we'll be making sure that Trish gets back okay.
Her husband broke into a low chuckle.
What's funny? Poncho asked.
If I were Chang, I'd look out for my job. You're going to wind up running the World Council, Ponch. She shook her head vigorously.
Hell no!
Then a sly grin crept across her lean face.
But I wouldn't mind taking a ride out to Sirius.
Understanding. For what a man had rather were true, he more readily believes. Numberless, in short, are the ways, and sometimes imperceptible, in which the affections color and infect the understanding. Francis Bacon. Back to the city. Jordan found himself whistling as he walked briskly through the woods toward the city. He chuckled to himself at Thornberry's depiction of diplomats in striped trousers. He was wearing casual pearl-gray slacks and an open-necked light-blue shirt, and looking forward to returning to the city, to Audrey and his enigmatic smiles, to Aditi and her warmth. The morning was cool, but bright shafts of sunlight filtered through the tall trees rising all around him. The forest seemed alive with buzzing insects and small, furry animals that scampered up the tree trunks or through the bushes of the tree's bases. Birds cawed as they swooped high above. He marveled at his cheerful mood.
What are you so chipper about? He asked himself,
and answered, I'm going to see Aditi again. Why shouldn't I be chipper? But then he thought, Meek is right, you know. We're in over our heads, involved in some vast interstellar intrigue, whether we like it or not. Well, I like it. This is the most exciting thing that's ever happened to me. An interstellar mystery. Fascinating. We have so much to learn, so much to gain. Then he remembered an old admonition. H.G. Wells, he recalled. Wells was the one who said that when kindly aliens visit Earth and say they've come to serve man, we should ask if they intend to serve us baked or fried.
Nonsense, Jordan scoffed. Xenophobia, pure and simple.
Still, I suppose I should be careful. Then he laughed to himself. It doesn't matter how careful we are. We're in the hands of a vastly superior civilization. Audrey could crush us if he wished, vaporize us, our camp, and the ship up in orbit to boot. But he said he needed our help. A brightly colored bird swooped low between the trees and squawked once, then flapped away. Jordan followed its flight until it was lost in the foliage high above. When he looked down again at the trail he was following, he saw Aditi standing there, waiting for him, with her cat-like pet Sleen twining around her ankle. His heart leaped. She was wearing a knee-length skirt of dark blue and a short-sleeved blouse of a lighter shade. Her smile lit up the forest. He hurried up to her.
Hello. Have I kept you waiting?
Not at all, Aditi replied, laughing. I knew when you'd get here.
Jordan kissed her lightly, and hand in hand they walked the rest of the way to the city's edge, while Sleen slinked off into the foliage. As they crossed the stone walkway that circled the city and started up its main street, Jordan said,
I've got to have a long talk with Audrey.
There's so much I need to learn, need to find out. Aditi nodded thoughtfully.
He's busy this morning, a meeting with the city's administrators.
Sounds dull.
But it's important. He said he'd meet us for lunch in his office.
Jordan smiled. That gives us the entire morning for ourselves.
None of the others are coming?
No, he said. Wondering how much he should tell her, he added slowly, They've decided to remain in camp for the time being. They're rather frightened of you.
Of me?
Of Audrey, of your people. The reality of all this is just starting to sink in on them.
And they're frightened of us? Why? We're not going to harm them.
Aditi, dear, I know that, and you know it. I think perhaps even the rest of my people know it in their heads. But in their hearts, in their guts, they're scared.
How odd, she said. Emotional.
We humans are frightened by the unknown, and there are such enormous unknowns involved here.
I suppose so,
she said, nodding. I want to help them get over their fears,